Hailing frequencies open, and welcome to Enterprising Individuals, the Star Trek discussion podcast that boldly goes into excruciating detail about the series, characters, and stories of the Star Trek universe. I'm your host, Aaron Coker, a.k.a. Caliban, and you say Yamato, I say Yamato. Let's call the whole thing a massive antimatter containment failure. I'm joined once again in this episode by Pete the Retailer. Pete is the host of the Star Wars Minute, a daily podcast where he and co-host Alex Robinson analyze, scrutinize, and celebrate the Star Wars movies 1 minute at a time. He's also the co-host of ABCDTOS, a podcast examining Star Trek, the original series, in alphabetical order. Pete, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I wasn't sure if you were going to mention that one. Is that like, you know, like a turf war or something like that? Yeah, he's the host of Star Wars Minute and maybe some other stuff.
Some other stuff, yeah. No, that's why you're here, and it's good to have you back aboard.
Well, thanks for having me.
Today we'll be talking about Contagion, the 11th episode of the second season of Star Trek The Next Generation. There's a lot of arguing over what is the all-time best episode of Star Trek The Next Generation. Titles like The Best of Both Worlds, or The Inner Light, or Darmok are often in contention for number one. There's similar disagreement over the worst episodes of TNG, though Shades of Grey is usually racing Code of Honor to the bottom. Absent from these lists, however, are the merely good episodes, the solid, unpraised hours of TNG that helped to establish The Next Generation as a reliable source of entertaining and important new sci-fi. No one would ever argue that Contagion or A Matter of Honor or Samaritan Snare are their favorite episodes, but they helped establish a baseline of quality and world-building for the heights that Trek would soon achieve. But we'll talk about that a little later in the show. First, Pete, it's great to have you back on the podcast. It was 2018 when you were last on, and a lot has changed since then. Specifically, you've made it all the way through the prequels on Star Wars Minute, and you're halfway through the movie that came out just before we last spoke, The Last Jedi.
That's true. Yeah, we're slowly catching up with reality.
It doesn't seem that slow. I mean, it's only been a couple years.
That's true.
Yeah, you're in movie number 8. And I think we might have talked a little the last time about how when you started Star Wars Minute, you know, you had the original trilogy in front of you, three films, and maybe you'd do the prequels if the interest was there. And now 8 years later, you've got an entire sequel trilogy, more TV shows and films on the way. Your job will now never be finished. You'll have to bequeath it to your children and Alex's children.
Yeah, even before that, when we started, we're like, well, we'll do Star Wars and see how it goes. And then I was like, yeah, that was fun.
Yeah.
I guess we'll do Empire and, you know, we'll see how, you know, once we do that, then just our completionist nature is we had to finish Return of the Jedi. And then right. In the midst of all that, yeah, it was just like, I guess we'll do the prequels, because then by that time we were having fun and we started to, you know, it started to be more of a job and less, though it still straddles job and hobby. It's a jobby. I don't know, but
a jobby. yeah, I like that.
It started to become more and more of a thing. And then they announced the new movies somewhere around there, and we got roped into all this. And every time we think we see the light at the end of the tunnel, then they just kind of throw in some more. So we'll see.
Have you ever had to go on like an extended break from doing the podcast?
Not for catch-up reasons, but just, you know, we gave ourselves a little breathing room between last season and this one. Before we started the Last Jedi, we had done, we started a separate show, because we don't do enough Star Wars podcasting, so we started a separate show called The Mandalorian, which does not go through minute by minute of The Mandalorian, but we do each episode. For season one, we did that kind of concurrently with what we are doing. I forgot how it overlapped, but season two, we're like, all right, we're not going to start our next season of the show until after the season of The Mandalorian's over, because we don't want to stretch ourselves too thin.
Yeah. Did you do Rogue One?
We did. We did Rogue One.
Wow. So that even Rogue One. So that's, wow, you just done an amazing amount of content. And if they don't, I mean, they're talking about... obviously, they're working on Rogue Squadron. If they ever get that Rian Johnson trilogy, but it seems like there's not a lot of activity. They're kind of receding into the future a little bit. So maybe at some point you'll have to kind of go dark for a little while until they catch up to you.
Yeah. We might either take a little break and then come back to do new ones, or there's also you know, if we slow ourselves down, our friends who do the Indiana Jones minute, they kind of ran out of steam partway through Crystal Skull. Okay. And they took an extended hiatus and then came back doing, instead of, I don't think they were even doing five. I think they were doing three a week or something like that. You know, we do five a week. I think they were doing three, and then when they came back, they just cut it down to one. Let's just take one a week, and that'll
sure
give them plenty of time to do the next one and see, you know, maybe they'll get the Indy 5 by the time they're done. But if we needed to shift gears, we can always just, you know, slow down our output for a while.
Maybe there'll be an Indy 6 by the time they make that decision.
Exactly.
What do you think about some of the current and upcoming projects, like the Obi-Wan show, a Rogue Squadron, a possible Rian Johnson trilogy?
You know, I'm I don't have the same, you know, it always used to be a cautious optimism. That was always our thing. And I think that both of those are diminished somewhat, knowing that the caution is diminished because I feel like it's in safe. There's nothing that can do that's going to ruin everything.
Sure.
There, you know, all the, like, worst comes to worst, it's going to be like, oh, yeah, that wasn't my favorite. You know, that's I feel like that's, you know, there's enough kind of quality control in there to make sure that it's at least going to be, yeah, that wasn't my favorite. But then also I feel like the optimism has also diminished somewhat, that I'm like, I'm absolutely going to watch every, you know, well, at least the live action stuff that comes out. I haven't really been roped into the animated shows and stuff yet, but I do have two kids, so that's, I'm sure that's down the pipe somewhere. But the live action, you know, the TV shows, the you know, Disney Plus shows that are coming out, and Rogue Squadron and all that, I don't have the same excitement for it that I once did, or even that I find that I have for the Marvel stuff. Like the Marvel stuff, I'm like, oh yeah, when is that coming out? And the Star Wars stuff, I'm just kind of like, oh yeah, that's on the horizon. We'll get, and
yeah,
it could be that it's, you know, it's my job. But I don't know. We'll see. I'm certainly not, you know, adverse to it. I'm not rolling my eyes saying like, oh, more Star Wars. But I'm a little bit of that enthusiasm is missing.
That's interesting. It possibly could be that it has become a job for you. I know when they recently announced the 23 weeks of Trek, when they were going to show Lower Decks and then immediately show Discovery afterwards, and we do a live show every Thursday when the show comes out.
Right.
And I was excited for the new shows, but it was also like, I got to do 23 weeks of a live show like in a row. But like you said, it's a jobby, so what are you going to do? And I have to say that I wasn't initially too keen on the idea of an Obi-Wan show, because I wasn't sure what they would really do on the show, what it would be about. But after the success of The Mandalorian, which was essentially just like Boba Fett the show, and following, or just finding stories to tell in between the live-action films, I'm a lot more optimistic about the idea of an Obi-Wan show.
Yeah, although I have a certain amount of, I don't know, boy, you know, for some reason, I feel like I'm coming off swinging negative on Star Wars, even though it's
well, you're on the right show for that.
Yeah,
I guess
so. Yeah, you Trek guys know what I'm talking about. I was hesitant. I'm like, Trek? No, it's not Trek guys. It's not Trekkers, Trekkies. I guess we've come back around on Trekkies, and nobody's. I remember for a while it was a term of kind of derision, but now it's just, I think we've owned it again, right?
I think so.
Even like, you know, as much as I was excited in the moment about The Mandalorian, and I was thrilled by what was going on, then as soon as we kind of took a step away and it was over, I was like, oh, wait a minute. I felt like that was a little bit of a cop-out overall, that it was like, it was super exciting when they were doing world building, and it's like, hey, here's new stories with something that we've never seen before. And then at the end, it was like, oh, just kidding, it was Boba Fett and Luke Skywalker. And I was like,
yeah,
I've seen those guys, and I want to see more of the, what about all that new stuff that you made up?
I had to be dragged into it, you know, by both feet. But as soon as it got kind of pastiche, you know, it was a real like Sergio Leone type thing. I was really excited initially, but as the show went on, it's like, oh, that's kind of all they've got, and someday they're going to run out of like spaghetti western and samurai movies to like kind of borrow from. So hopefully, like the very last episode, I know people were torn over having Luke show up, but I thought it was kind of finally starting to find its own voice and not necessarily just literally do the Seven Samurai or literally do baby Cartahades or whatever, you know, whatever they were sort of borrowing from. Hmm. So
see, that's why I was the opposite. I was like, instead of finding its own voice, it's losing its own voice to borrow old voice from.
It's just
going to be coming up. It's the Boba Fett show, and Luke Skywalker's here, and all this other, like, remember?
Yeah.
Remember this? It's Remember This, the show.
So. Yeah, well, a lot of franchises are falling into that recently.
Whereas, I mean, it was the whole time, but it was more like, remember this toy? And I'm like, yeah, I remember that toy.
Instead, yeah, you know, I guess it was always that. Yeah. But now it's just bald-faced. Yeah. Do you still have the 8-day Greedo line?
We do. There was a little, I could say it's a technical error, but it's more of a kind of me not being on top of things. That it was active, but not really... not checked very often for a while.
Okay.
And then I recently set it back up, so it's fully functional, and we've run a few calls this season from that.
What kind of calls do you get on it?
Yeah, that just came up not too long ago. Like, one of our guests was like, hey, you guys are really brave for basically opening up a phone yeah. line and saying, hey, call me and tell me about your feelings about The Last Jedi.
Right, yeah.
But, we get, I mean, I think, you know, because we've stressed what kind of things we like to hear on that. And really, if you're, I don't know, I feel like if your attitude about The Last Jedi is going to be the kind of thing that we would find objectionable, then you probably aren't with us for very long. You know what I mean? I feel like
Sure.
The people who enjoy our show, even if they don't like The Last Jedi, they're not the type to just kind of be venomous about it, you know. They're more just kind of like, yeah, I didn't like that, and like, you know, they have reasons, and they're you know, completely legitimate in liking and not liking whatever they want, and you know, that, but that kind of measured conversation is something that I feel like we've cultivated amongst our fans, hopefully at least the ones that interact with us. So
yeah,
so for the most part, we haven't gotten anybody just calling and being like, this movie sucks. we did branch out. We've been doing YouTube this season. We put our shows up on YouTube, and some of those, you know, YouTube being YouTube, when we first started doing that, a couple of comments would pop up that were just like, this movie sucks. And if you just kind of, you know, don't feed the trolls, as the saying goes, you know, and just
right.
nobody didn't rush in to defend it, didn't rush just to, you know, ignore it. Don't dignify it If somebody comes in and is like, oh, I disagree with what you were saying about this episode because X, Y, and Z, that will totally interact with me. Like, oh, yeah, I see your point, and I thought it was like this. But
right.
But if they just wander through looking for a fight, then, it, you know, they're not going to get anything, and they go away.
Yeah. Plus, Rise of Skywalker gave us all a Predator meme handshake that we could all agree on is this is the one we can all hate together.
I love the Rise of Skywalker.
Wow.
Yeah.
I really wish this wasn't a Star Trek show so we could talk about that more.
Yeah, it's going to be, and not, you know, not for the reasons why, you know, I think a lot of people do. Not, you know, I don't, or not for the reasons why a lot of people hated The Last Jedi, which I also love. You know, I love both and for completely different reasons, but yeah, that's 2 years from now. That'll be a fun season because Alex also is not a big fan of it, but I am, and I'm making a little mental note in my book of all the people who I know personally that also liked it, so I can get some support down the road. But
nice. Well, I can't wait to hear that in 2 years. I asked you last time that you were on about what you thought about how Disney was handling the management of Star Wars. How do you think Viacom is doing with Star Trek?
I'll have to get back to you on that because I haven't, you know, I literally just a couple of weeks ago signed up for Paramount Plus and have not really been keeping up with all the new stuff. I've only watched like the first half of the pilot of Discovery and I was like, this is good. I'll have to get back to this.
Sure.
And I have not watched any of the rest of it. I haven't watched any of Picard or Lower Decks or anything. I'm like, okay, this is all stuff that I'm going to need to get back to and check out, but I kind of keep tabling it and putting it off a little bit, and I don't know. It's a time management issue, not a critical choice. Other than that, I mean, how far back was that, including the Kelvin stuff or what's how do you feel? I feel like that's a completely different decision making. They've shifted gears after the Kelvin stuff to do this kind of this new,
it
new
is,
patch of stuff,
isn't it? Yeah. But it's all kind of in the same vein, I guess. I guess, like, if I was to answer that question, I'd say that that's probably the biggest problem. Like, I like all the new Trek shows, but I think they're really dropping the ball in the movie department. I think that Star Trek films are so iconic, and of course, the original series ones, you know, kept the Trek alive when it was off TV.
Yeah.
And cinematic universes and horizontal marketing are so popular right now that I can't believe that they just can't, you know, get it together and just make some more Star Trek films.
Yeah, to do, like, you know, three and then just drop it there, even if it's, you know, so, all right, so what? You can't get the same, you know, creative team. You can't get, you know, I'm sure you could get at least some of the cast,
yeah,
you know, back on board for another, you know, two, three movies, maybe, whatever, you know, just like,
sure,
like if you can make that work, and instead there's just I think it's a little bit too you know, is it that lack of kind of guiding vision, which they don't, you know, I feel like Star Wars is still operating to a certain extent under the shadow of George Lucas, and has Star Wars fully escaped the shadow of Roddenberry?
Possibly.
That it's like there's no, you know, everybody's pulling it in a different direction. And it's kind of like, you know, outside of that chain reaction of, you know, Next Generation to Deep Space Nine Voyager, and then Enterprise, you know, is where it kind of didn't go off the rails, but it, you know, that's where at least the I feel like the chain reaction stopped, and then they were like, they stopped to rethink it, and that, I feel like outside of that, then, like, Star Trek has always been that a little bit, like, it happened with the toys. Like, I don't know, have you watched that episode of Toys That Made Us? Documentary series about the Star Trek toys, and it always should have been a hit, but then it's just one misstep, and then they try to correct, or things change, and it's always behind the scenes something, and it's the series of pratfalls that just totally undermine what should have at some point been a hit collection, because it's, you know, a popular franchise. It's one of the top franchises, you know, almost invented the modern franchise. And I feel like they're falling into those same holes with you know, production of the actual, you know, entertainment product. But and it seems like now that at least they've got a little momentum and a little bit of a kind of chain reaction thing going with the CBS, you know, Paramount Plus shows, but again, I haven't gotten a chance to check it out yet.
They need to have the confidence of Universal, who just keeps trying to make these monster movies with no momentum at all. They just keep doing it.
Exactly. That's the, just, you know, head down, get through it, and then don't try to course correct while you're part of the way through it. And
right.
Just do what you're doing. Let it, you know, finish out the cycle and then look back. Don't keep looking up, or keep looking up. I don't know. That's, looking up seems like a very Star Trek thing to do. Like, yeah, keep looking up, but don't keep looking back. There you go.
Yeah, look up. Don't look at the returns. Yeah, that's what I'm doing with this podcast. So, with the completion of ABC Devo, you haven't been idle. You've been doing another alphabetical review podcast in ABCD TOS. What was the reasoning behind tackling the original series?
Well, the guys who I do ABC, you know, we did ABC Devo. And then once we're done, we're like, that was a lot of fun. I love talking to you guys every week or whatever. Let's what are we going to do next? And every band that we came up with, nobody had that same connection. Well, not nobody, but, you know, like, it would be like, oh, somebody did, but not all four of us did, or two of us did, but not all four of us did. You know, we kept going through different bands to be like, well, no, I know. I mean, I like the Cars, but I'm not really that, you know, they don't hit me on the same level.
Yeah.
And the more we went through it, the more kind of, you know, dead ends we would hit. But like, Star Trek references kept coming up. And then at some point it was just like, well, one thing I feel like we can all agree on is the original series, right? It was like, well, yeah, obviously we all love that. I'm like, oh, let's just do that alphabetically.
Yeah.
And no questions, no arguments. Just like, oh, yeah, sure.
Something that we all have access to. We've all got Netflix or what have you.
Yeah. Although disappointingly, I canceled my Prime account a little while back, so I don't, as far as I can tell, I don't have access anywhere to the unremastered ones, which
Oh, right.
Having that comparison is neat, and I figured, hey, of course, Paramount Plus, they own this. Of course they would have everything, but no, they don't.
No, they don't have that. I've heard you talk on the show about the differences between Memory Alpha and Wikipedia and how they're organized and structured differently and what that might say about Trek fans versus Wars fans. And it made me wonder, I'm sure you guys get emails and comments all the time about both, you know, Trek and Star Wars. What is the actually situation like between Trek fans and Wars fans? What kind of comments do you get, you know, correcting you or the sort of niggling details that Trek fans complain about?
Yeah, I feel like it's more. I feel like Star Trek fans will you know, actually you for stuff that's at least represented on screen more, whereas Star Wars fans like to give you like a gotcha on something like, no, that was in a novel, you know, that was in a junior reader's novelization. How could you not know that alien species was? And it's like, well, come on, like, I didn't. Like, why would I know that versus, you know, in Trek, at least it's like related to like, oh, like, no, actually that thing that he's looking at on screen is this. And it's like, oh, okay. Like that, you know, that's the kind of thing that I feel like we dabble in more on Star Wars Minute, that we're like, all right, if we see it on screen, then we like to have fun with, oh, what's the name of that? And where does that come from? You know?
Right, right.
And, but not, you know, just like, oh, like this, you know, going off on these crazy wild adventures, which I'm not going to say that, you know, people shouldn't like the books and all that. I think that's great that you know, it's an important part of fandom is the, you know, novelizations and spin-off projects and stuff like that. But like, you can't fault somebody for not knowing stuff that's from these kind of disparate sources.
It's weird because they're both, you know, one's a TV production for the most part and one's a movie production. And it's, I don't know if that affects it or if it's, The idea that like Star Wars is like this legendary thing, you know, when you think about it, Star Trek is, they're all logs, right? These are all records of things that have like happened.
Right.
And I don't know how that affects how people approach it, but I knew that Star Wars fans had a special approach to things when I was on Wikipedia and I saw that there was a wiki page for Hell. Because Han Solo says that he'll see somebody in hell, which is just an expression. Yeah. But now they have to come up with like, oh, hell is a chaos dimension that exists. And it's like, guys, it doesn't matter. He just says he's still seeing hell. Don't take that away.
Yeah, it's my favorite Wikipedia entries are just like, well, you know, because like Anakin's friend, who was like the daughter of one of the, you know, assistant directors or whatever, had braces when she was, you know,
in
The Phantom Menace. Now we have to write a Wikipedia entry for braces. And it's just like,
yeah.
Braces are something that creatures wore on their teeth to correct them. And it's like,
yes, right.
Yeah, I get that. That's we know what braces are. Thank you.
That means there's health insurance in the Star Wars universe.
Well, hopefully.
Why did you want to talk about Contagion today?
Contagion is, but you really nailed it in the intro with like, it's not the best and it's not the worst. And I really do want it to be the best whenever I got, I'm like, yeah, like, because I love one of the writers. Steve Gerber is one of my personal heroes as far as writing and storytelling goes. And, you know, I had this kind of discovery when I worked at Discovery, wrong show. When I had this, kind of, you know, I was working at a comic book shop for a number of years, and when you know, I took kind of that next step from being a fairly casual fan into, you know, it's easy when you're surrounded by all this stuff to then go like, oh, okay, now I'm going to learn about, you know, more of the creators behind it and the, you know, the backstory behind, you know, you start to get into that next level of fandom of knowing more behind the scenes stuff rather than being just like, you know, like, I like Wolverine. And so I had this kind of like discovery. I'm like, oh, wait a minute. A lot of these things, these quirky things that I like more than a lot of the other people that I know, Steve Gerber is behind them. And it was this like snowball effect of like, okay, well, I've always been a Man Thing fan since I discovered him. And it started as a joke, but then I became a real honest to goodness, like huge Man Thing fan. And, turns out, oh, that's his defining run, you know, his run on that is the defining, you know, the definitive man thing. I'm like, oh right. Steve Gerber. Okay. What else has this guy done? Oh, he created Howard the Duck. Oh, I loved Howard the Duck when I was a kid. Sure. I loved that movie. And I, you know, went back and read some of the comics. I was like, oh, these are really good too. And then what else has he worked on? And, you know, checked out more of his comics work. And it was like, oh, he also wrote for TV. He created Thundar the Barbarian. That was my favorite show when I was like seven, you know.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and it kept going. And it was more like the more threads that I pulled out, I'm like, oh, Steve Gerber is involved in that.
Yeah.
And then it was like, oh, he wrote an episode of Star Trek, The Next Generation. That's got to be awesome. Like, I can't believe he did that. And then I went back and watched it. It was like, oh, yeah, this one. Yeah. Yeah. It's all right. It's a little bit like, you know, my hopes were built up too high going into it, but it's not, like you said, it's not the worst. It's not bad, but it's a real, you know, there's like a handful of ideas that don't get fully realized, but I need to somehow express, I will give up, use any chance to talk about Steve Gerber, so I do want to talk about this, and I've been really itching to get back into talking or viewing refamiliarizing myself with The Next Generation. So
yeah,
I'm using any excuse to rewatch those. I think the going through the original series has rekindled my Star Trek love in general, which is then going to lead me back into Next Gen, which I haven't spent much time with since it was on.
Yeah. I think the general consensus is that TNG really picks up in the third season. That's where it really finds its identity.
Right.
But I have a soft spot for a lot of second season episodes. Maybe it's because, like, I think I had Contagion on, like, a VHS. Mm. This is when I was, like, you know, taping, like, TNG off of TV. And you get those episodes that you watch 100 times because it's all you've got. But in the second season, the show moves – I think it moves – or starts to move beyond the weird characterizations and the kind of stunted sexuality and the retread TOS plots that they're kind of bringing in from TOS. Not fully. Some of that's still there, but the show really starts world building and delivering some good episodes. And I'm kind of a sucker for the just another episodes. I mean, you've got Measure of a Man,
right?
You know, which stops you dead, and everybody thinks about how great it is and the speechifying. But yeah, I like episodes like Contagion, where it's just like business as usual. You know, you're just delivering like another kind of interesting hour of Star Trek.
Yeah, it does seem like this has what. Well, I won't say it's best of both worlds, because that's, but it does have one foot in each world of kind of like, it is a little bit of a, almost like a leftover TOS plot, but with an extra layer of world building and interesting kind of like extra, like you can see where the show came from and you can see where the show's going at the same time in this one. So it's an interesting, it's very, it's like a brackish episode.
Yeah, right. And a lot of that, estuary. A lot of that is down to Gerber's writing, I think. I think a lot of the change from the second to the third season is the waning influence of Roddenberry, or maybe his meddling lawyer, Leonard Mazelish.
Right.
And also the final departure of embattled showrunner Maurice Hurley and his replacement by Michael Piller. And I have a theory that I've been working on. I might do an episode on it someday, but the theory is that the early days of TNG were kind of marred by the fact that Gene Roddenberry and later the people that he left in charge before he left the show were all trying to hold Trek to some previously existing concept of what it was. I've seen many, many interviews with people like Maurice Hurley or Rick Berman, you know, the people who were left in charge after Gene's departure, who say that it was their job to, you know, quote unquote, preserve Gene's vision.
Right.
And it's usually in response to comments about how writers felt frustrated or had they had to turn ideas down or they had refused to do stories about particular social issues like homosexuality or diversity. And the perennial line is that they had to preserve Gene's vision. And it's only when Gene himself steps away and Maurice Hurley quits the show, once the seeming gatekeepers are removed, that the show is able to suddenly take more risks and expand its scope beyond just being a sequel series to TOS.
Yeah. Yeah, it really... it's a tough... they were put in a tough spot. You know, it's a regular Phantom Menace situation that there's like, there's no way that's going to live up to expectations. I mean, I remember that clearly, similar but different feelings. I remember how excited I was about the debut of Next Gen and being, you know, confronted with Encounter at Farpoint and being like, yeah, that was good. Like, that was all right. It was Trekkie. You know, it was a very... It was very much, you know, the message of Star Trek underneath it, but I wasn't like, yeah, I got to watch this every week. It was like, oh, that was fun. I'll watch that again, you know. And And to escape that shadow, I think they do, you know, I do often think about what was lost or what was, you know, cast aside maybe of that Star Trek vibe, you know, that original Star Trek heart, you know, did we shed any of that? You know, is it the, you know, the kind of, you know, make love to the alien kind of, you know, Roddenberry spine that you know, is behind everything? Did we lose too much of that? But I think, you know, it's the same with you know, Star Trek II, with Wrath of Khan, for it to be like, yeah, you made a good movie and it's a popular movie, but it's also like, did we sell our soul here to do this? Like, this is just a this is a big dumb action movie, which I love, and it's got some great Star Trek, very Star Trek bits in it, but like, did we, you know, we did turn it very much into a like shoot 'em up, let's blow up the other guy thing, which is, you know, which, you know, granted, there's some of that in the original series, so I'm not saying it's a definite, but it's something that we at least I find myself questioning all the time.
Yeah, I wonder if Gene had the budget, if he would have done, you know, a Yesterday's Enterprise or a Best of Both Worlds.
Yeah, I don't know.
As long as they were fighting God, that would be fine with him.
Right. If he was in there somewhere.
Well, we're talking the Star Trek Next Gen episode, Contagion. It first aired on March 20th of 1989. It was written by Steve Gerber and Beth Woods. And as you mentioned, Gerber is best known as the creator of Howard the Duck, although he's responsible for the creation of many other characters for Marvel Comics, as well as writing seminal runs on Man-Thing and the original Guardians of the Galaxy. What I did not know about him until I started researching was that he co-created and story edited the animated series Thundar the Barbarian. He also served as story editor and writer on cartoons like G.I. Joe, Transformers, and Dungeons & Dragons, and he wrote for cartoons like the Plastic Man Comedy Adventure Hour, the Scooby and Scrappy-Doo Puppy Hour, the Superman and Batman animated series, and the new Batman Adventures, and he created one of the most impactful characters of the Bronze Age, Elf with a Gun.
That's right. Everybody's favorite. Everybody remembers Elf with a Gun.
Elf with a Gun is like, it's funny because it's, you know, it's striking, but also it, I think, encapsulates his attitude about hit writing, you know, just like, you know, what's the reason? No reason. Like, this character just shows up and you think that it's building to some big confrontation with the Defenders or whatever, and then he gets hit by a truck. And then that was it. He just wanted to kind of play a trick on the audience, and I think that really is his style. I remember the Howard the Duck comics from when I was young, but they were aimed over my head. You know, I didn't really, like, get them.
Yeah, same. I didn't really get into those until I was in my kind of 20s and being like, oh, I get it now.
Yeah. And by the time the Howard the Duck movie came around, like, I think I was old enough. I think I was like the wrong age for it. Like, I watch it now and think, all right, this is fun. But at that time I was like, I wanted something really cool. And Howard the Duck did not really deliver that movie wise.
No. Yeah. I that was absolutely my first exposure to the, you know, to the character via the movie. And I liked it. But I, you know, I liked a lot of stuff at the time. So
I had an old, it was one of those big digest size comics, like from the late 70s or early 80s. And it had a Hulk, Hulk Fights Havoc story in it. It had a Man-Thing story in it. I think there was a Howard the Duck. And then the Hulk was beating on the leader or something like that.
Right.
And I read that thing until it fell apart. And like you do when you're a kid, you know, you just get comics, catch as catch can, from the drugstore or whatever. And I had no idea what was going on beforehand, no idea where the stories went after. But I just, you know, read those over and over again. And I really liked it.
Yeah. Yeah. Same thing. You know, I between Discount Comics and then really my, you know, unsurprisingly, if you go back and, you know, analyze, you know, look at my work and realize that some of my favorite comics of all time are the Official Handbook of the Marvel Universe, where it's just, here's everybody's story. Here's how much they can lift. Here's, you know, their, how they got their powers. Here's how tall they are. Here's, you know, who their mother-in-law is. And it's like, oh, okay. Like, that's totally, I absorbed those like nobody's business, you know? And, but there was an artifact of that. Not to turn this too much into a comics podcast, but the thing with Steve Gerber, he created Howard the Duck, and then over arguments with Marvel over royalties, mainly stemming from the comic strip that he was, where the artist wasn't getting the proper royalties. The artist that was drawing the comic strip, the syndicated comic strip. That's how popular Howard the Duck was. Got into an argument with them over that, which then led to him leaving and led to a lawsuit. And there was a whole lot of kind of bad blood and legal action and whole lot of business. Could be a whole show. That could be a podcast. Oh, hey, wait a minute. Let me write that down. I'll go do that. And I'll. but the side effect of that indirectly affected me is that all started happening right before I got into comics. Mm-hmm. Or right around, so it was, he was there for the debut of the movie. He was still around and still giving quotes for the movie, but then right around then is when they started fighting and pulled the plug. So as a result, like, any of his kind of pet characters also kind of got shelved, and things that he had created, they totally put on ice in case, you know, pending the results of this lawsuit. So if he, you know, had come back with this, you know, landmark decision in favor of creators' rights, and it turns out they had to pay him, you know, for everything he created, they weren't going to keep, you know, shoveling coal on the fire. That's
right, right.
Stopped using a lot of his trademark characters and ones that he created. And then, but that's the same era that these handbooks came out. So I'm reading about these characters and, like, you know, most of them, like, yeah, Captain America, right. Yeah, you know, all these, you know, going down to the obscure, except for the, some of them, it's just like, wait a minute, why have I never heard of this character? Like, how come Angar the Screamer isn't in any stories? You know, like,
yeah,
why?
Sure, yeah.
I don't think he created Angar, but he, but Wundar, the Aquarian. Like, how come the Aquarian isn't in any stories? And it, and then again, this kind of going back and looking at things and you know, realizing as an adult, like, oh, like, a lot of these weird characters that I love because they're ridiculous and they were in the handbook and that's the only place that I know them from. It's because a lot of them were Steve Gerber characters and they stopped using them because of the lawsuit.
Right.
And so that kind of retroactively, you know, that, had that effect. I forgot how we got here. And I just took us on a weird trip where I just really always want to talk about, Wundar, the Aquarian.
I think it's something that we've lost with just the decompression in storytelling in comics these days, that constant reminder of where we are, because every issue you pick up could be somebody's first issue. So in between the handbook and Stan Lee coming in to tell you, you know, what was going on before, or every single character telling you about the focus totality of their psychic power or whatever.
Yeah.
You got a general idea. There was no way I was ever going to get my hands on the Dark Phoenix saga when I was a kid. So I had to just hear about it because Cyclops would tell you every time somebody mentioned, you know, who Jean was.
Right.
And something that comic companies are worried about these days is, you know, people watching a movie, watching Spider-Man, and then coming to get a comic book and not knowing what's going on, which is why they're, like, doing number one issues all the time.
Yeah.
And if they just, you know, just publish these these handbooks again, people could get filled in.
Yeah. This could be another whole, you know, whole rant show that I could easily get into. But the problem with comics, you know, as an ex-comics retailer and a comics fan of many years, it's like they just keep digging themselves these holes, because every jumping on point is a jumping off point. Every reboot, you lose people. And
right.
I know you're trying to kind of, you know, capture this mythological new readers that are only going to read it if it's a new number one issue and number one sell better and all this other, like, nonsense that's, you know, the marketing and sales team kind of guiding the company as opposed to the creative team, which is, you know, building good quality stories that will last for forever.
Right.
So they're, I don't know. They're, I'm sure, you know, if bring this to the people who control the dollars and cents, and they'll be like, yeah, well, nobody cares about what you, you know, your opinions about it don't matter. Look, we're still making money off of these, but they really have done a terrible job of kind of maintaining that, you know, part of the, you know, with Star Trek and with you know, stuff like X-Men. So I'm trying to bring it back around too. That part of it was the excitement. Part of what I loved about it was jumping in kind of midstream.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I never got, you know, there's not an origin episode of the original series. You know, there's the you know, where No Man Has Gone Before, which is, you know, a, you know, second or third pilot. And you know, you get, you know, the cage repurposed into the menagerie. But even those don't tell you, like, well, here's, I'm, you know, it's my first day as captain of the Enterprise. It's just like, you know, everything you need to know. Right. Yeah. Is, it's just like, yeah, it's Star Trek. Here, we're going on a 5-year mission. We're exploring stuff. Great. You know what I mean? That's like the, so that, that, you know, jumping at X-Men, exactly, same thing. If they didn't, you know, anything you needed to know, somebody's going to tell you in their, you know, thought bubbles of anxiety or out loud or, you know, through copious Chris Claremont narration or Steve Gerber, who's also very, or, you know, narration heavy.
Yes. Yeah, plus it's like, I think the medium is in a position where these characters have been around and extant for so long, maybe we're reaching the limits of what the attention that you can hold from an audience. You know what I mean? Like, I'm spoiled because I grew up as an X-Men fan and the same guy wrote them for almost 2 decades.
Right.
So that's all in his head. Like, he's continually, I'm sure he leaves a lot of stories that never go anywhere, but he's always bringing the narrative back and developing it. And so if somebody jumps on to a book, now we're going to take a different direction. That's sort of like a mini reboot, but I don't know. Star Trek is definitely facing that problem just with creating new shows and trying to get new fans. And it's something that all franchises have to deal with. But yeah, suffice it to say, Steve Gerber was a great guy, a great creator. You know, he passed away in 2008, but his legacy is still with us, specifically with the very idea of Howard the Duck and the film. And I'm sure you know this story, but Howard the Duck, of course, was produced by your boy, George Lucas. And it is indirectly or maybe directly responsible for the creation of Pixar. In 86, when the film came out, after Lucas's divorce, and with Return of the Jedi toy sales dropping, and I think they knew that Howard the Duck was going to be something of an egg when it came out. George had bills to pay, so he sold the computer graphics division of Lucasfilm to Steve Jobs, who renamed it Pixar, and the rest is history.
Mm-hmm. There you go. See, again, Steve Gerber is behind everything.
Yes, right. Steve Gerber, Steve Jobs, all the Steves.
Yeah, I've been handed an update. He did, in fact, invent Angry the Screamer. So,
there you go. There you go. Perfect. As for Beth Woods, I don't mean to undersell her, but I think the story gets even more interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't know about this until kind of reading it for this show.
Yeah, and if I miss anything, fill it in. But Beth Woods, sometimes credited as Beth Slick, has only 2 credits, Captain Simian and the Space Monkeys, which is a TV cartoon show, and of course, Contagion for TNG. She also submitted a script to Paramount called Our Brother's Keeper, which became part of the basis for the TNG episode Sins of the Father, which is a very important Worf story as well. And she was apparently a computer tech at Paramount and a Star Trek fan. And I guess just like knew Steve Gerber. I'm not exactly sure what their working relationship was, but they pitched this idea. And she had to explain to Gene Roddenberry the idea of computer viruses to try to sell the show. That must have been fun. She was the author of several computer self-help books in the 90s. Like Norton and Word for Dummies, and she co-wrote BBS's for Dummies with Steve Gerber, which I gotta get my hands on. I'm not sure how I'm gonna do that. And I started looking into her life, and thank God that we've got Google and being able to search for names and facts and things like that, because I discovered that she was a sci-fi fan when she was young, in the early 70s, and she took over as editor for a fanzine called Tight Beam. And in the beginning of the zine, she would, like you do, you have an editor's letter, and she's just kind of giving people updates on her life, and she talks about how she's, you know, she's clearly a Star Trek fan after the ending of the show, but, you know, in the early 70s when Star Trek fandom exploded. And she's talking about how she wants to move to Hollywood because she wants to write for TV, and so she's going to do that. And she there's one editor letter that where she talks about how she got to see an unreleased sci-fi movie called Dark Star, and she thought it was really funny.
Nice.
And then several days later, she had a nice conversation with the movie's director and writer, who is John Carpenter.
Right.
And I thought that was. And she talks about, like, she got to meet Robert Culp, and she thought that was kind of fun. And I found later a list of the distribution of the magazine, and it's just a bunch of names, but I was like, names. Forrest J. Ackerman, interesting. Frederick Pohl, okay. Philip Jose Farmer, oh my God, this is incredible. Like, so she's the person that was just like at the birth of a lot of these of the explosion of fandom, and I don't know how that gets her to being like an IT professional for Paramount in the 1980s, which is how she got hooked up with Star Trek. But it was just fascinating.
Yeah, I didn't know that. That's awesome. I had just heard the boiled down version of, you know, yeah, she was, you know, basically the IT person and you know, pitched an idea. And I thought they paired her with Gerber, but that doesn't make any sense because he would be, it makes a lot more sense that he comes from the computer world because he was always a big computer nerd.
Interesting.
And
okay.
A very online guy, even in the early days.
Sure.
Which was another, you know, the culmination of my Steve Gerber fascination, you know, in the, I guess the 2000s, right? I don't, then he was, you know, he still kind of maintained a forum or a, or no, it was the Yahoo group, the Howard the Duck Yahoo group. He was still actively a part of.
Oh, okay.
And joined that, and that was like a little tight knit group that would always, it's basically Howard the Duck, but also just all things Steve Gerber because he was there and he would, you know, interact with us and we'd get to talking about stuff. And
yeah. I read a interview with Steve where he was talking about working on the show and working with Gene Roddenberry and the reasons why he didn't do another Star Trek, which was because of working with Gene Roddenberry, which is true of a lot of people.
Right.
But he talked about one time that he and Beth had dinner with Roddenberry to talk about the script. And instead, they ended up talking about his struggles with Marvel Comics and Gene's struggles with Star Trek over licensing and the Star Trek films and stuff like that. And just, they just went for hours talking about their woes over IP.
I can totally understand that. I'm sure they have similar, not similar gripes, but they both can gripe about similar things, pulling from different directions. But
yeah,
I can totally see that.
Well, this episode was directed by Joseph L. Scanlan. Scanlan directed four episodes of TNG in total, the other three being The Big Goodbye, Skin of Evil, and Time Squared. And Scanlan was reportedly unhappy with how rambunctious the cast would act on set, and he vowed to never direct another episode of Trek, and that's what happened. I've heard these stories about how, like, Brent Spiner and everybody, and Michael Dorn are cutting up, and even Patrick Stewart, I think the first year, was like, this is my big break. Knock it off, guys. Like, stop screwing around. But he eventually came around and played around with the cast. He got his start directing episodes of the long-running soap The Secret Storm in 1972. And he would go on to direct for other shows like Land of the Lost, The Littlest Hobo, Falcon Crest, Quantum Leap, Briscoe County Jr., The 90s Outer Limits, Earth Final Conflict, and six episodes of The Star Lost, which means that once again, we get to play my favorite game. Has the guest heard of The Star Lost?
Yes, heard of, but I get it conflated with a couple of things. Star Lost was that the one with the generation ship?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Yes. Cordwainer Burns.
Yeah.
Birds.
Yeah,
Canadian. Yeah. Television show from the '70s. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. He's got a lot of long rants about that in the,
yes,
in some of his nonfiction books.
Yeah. I don't know why. I really like that show. It's like a, I don't know why. I like Generation Ship shows. I like Kira D'Elia, and I don't know. It's just weird and low budget.
Yeah. I know of it, but I've never checked it out. I should.
Good luck finding
anywhere?
It.
Yeah, that's probably not.
Yeah, I don't think so. I actually have to retire this game now because I had author Greg Cox on the show recently and I asked him about it and he's like, oh, yeah, The Star Lost. I remember talking with Ben Bova when he was writing Starcrossed and his experiences working on the show. So he schooled me up and down on Star Lost.
Oh, man.
It's my dream to get Walter Koenig on the show and ask him about the time that he was on Star Lost.
Yeah, that would be... He's got to have... He's got to have a ton of interesting stories. And his, you know, his son-in-law is a famous podcaster. How is he not doing more podcasting?
I don't know, but see if we can change that. Scanlan passed away just last year in December at the age of 91. The start date for this episode is 42609.1, and your assignment, Pete, if you can, is to give us a 25-word synopsis of Contagion.
25 words. All right. Let's, these don't count towards it. Hang on.
Okay.
ancient computer virus in neutral zone infects Enterprise and Romulan. I'm doing it too. I'm gonna I'm going to end early here because I'm doing it like Telegraph style.
Just right, like, right. Stop.
Enterprise in danger. Stop. yeah, it infects Enterprise and Romulan ship. But have you tried turning it on and off again? I think that's the solution.
I think that's pretty good. Yeah, there really aren't any like B plots or side plots in this. I guess there's maybe Riker, you know, dealing with taking command, but also letting his captain go. And then Wes has a little after school special moment with Picard about the destruction of the Yamato.
Yeah, that seemed a little. I couldn't tell if that was good or bad because it was. It was. You know, I'm a Wesley defender because I was totally,
yeah.
You know, I was like approximately that age when I was watching this.
Yeah.
I don't know how much older than Will Wheaton. How much older is Will Wheaton than? He's 3 years older than me, and okay. So he's always like the closest. You know, in a lot of things, I'm like, oh yeah, him. Like I already knew kind of. I was aware of his existence from stuff like, you know, obviously like Stand By Me and whatever else.
Yeah.
But then on this, it was purely like, oh yeah, this is my, and it's cliche and it's exactly what I'm sure they were thinking on a executive level. They're like, let's have a kid so we can get some kids, get some interest in this. Yeah. And I'm like, I'm a kid and I'm interested. This is my in to this show.
Right. It worked.
It worked. I will totally defend Wesley because it was my entree into this.
I think this is a good use of Wesley. Like if you've got a Wesley, if Wesley is forced on you, I think this is a good way to use him because he's asking a question here that he'd know nothing about the Iconian civilization. And it gives Picard a chance to tell him and the audience about it. And also, you know, we get used to how intrepid and stoic our main characters are, and having a character who's like, wow, we just watched like 1,000 people die. That's kind of doing something to me. Having Picard be able to say, well, that's okay. You know, that's, you know, you'll be trained to handle that.
Yeah. It's weird. Like, it's like, I can't tell if it's good or bad. Cause it does. It's a little bit, heavy handed, but it also accomplishes like 3 or 4 different things in this one scene.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a little, it's like a little bit, all right, well, you know, show don't tell or whatever, but it's also like, all right, well, you just handled like, you know, giving us more exposition about the ancient civilization and kind of, you know, humanizing the, you know, sense of loss that we should be feeling here, and also setting up the, you know, one of the first kind of indications that things are going wrong on the Enterprise, plus, you know, also bringing in the, you know, having that Wesley Picard kind of relationship a little bit.
Sure.
So it does accomplish a lot, but it's a little bit rough. I think, I don't know, maybe something in the execution, but overall, not great, but not terrible either.
This is an episode of several firsts. This is the first time that a Galaxy-class starship blows up on screen.
Yeah.
This is the first named Romulan warship that we see, the Hakona. It's the first appearance of the Iconians and Iconian gateways. We would see another Iconian gateway in the DS9 episode To the Death. And they are mentioned in Discovery and Voyager, and of course all through extended media. This is the first time that Captain Picard orders tea Earl Grey hot, although he doesn't receive it.
Right.
And it's the first time that we hear about his interest in archaeology.
Yeah, I feel like as much as, you know, I watched this every week when it was on, and somehow I missed that, or maybe it just didn't become as much of a thing until kind of internet and meme culture. But I was like, oh, I remember having this feeling later in the, you know, 90s or early aughties or something of some, like, wait a minute, I watched all the episodes. Why don't I think that T. Earl Grey hot is a thing? Like, I realized, you know, like now I'm like, oh yeah, it's a thing that he ordered. And okay, I get it now. Cause now I guess my brain is more angled towards that. But I guess at the time I wasn't just like, he said the thing. I was just like, yeah, that's just something he says.
Right.
Like I missed it being a, you know, a meme. Maybe my brain wasn't ready for that. I just was accepting it as dialogue. But
your brain comes from an earlier generation before we have to strip all the context out of things and just memeify them in a picture. Right.
But then retroactively going back, I'm glad that we got that in the one that we picked for this, because it's like, oh, look, it's the first time that he says tea Earl Grey hot.
That's right.
Although then he gets a plant. So
yeah, which is not, it's not even close to tea. Although maybe if you got like a potted plant with the tea leaves still growing or something like that, but it's a completely random plant. Let's talk about the guest stars in the episode. Thalmas Rasulala plays Donald Varley in the episode. And one of Rasulala's earliest roles was as an original cast member of One Life to Live when the show debuted in 1968. He'd go on to a prolific career in television and film, appearing in movies such as Blackula, Willie Dynamite, and Cornbread Earl and Me. He also had recurring roles on Sanford and Son and What's Happening as Skeeter Matthews and Bill Thomas, respectively. And he played the role of Amoro Kinte, Kunta Kinte's father, in the miniseries Roots. He also acted on Broadway, and he played Cornelius Hackle in an all-black production of Hello, Dolly, which also featured Pearl Bailey and Cab Calloway. And where can I get that on video? That sounds great. He passed away in 1991, not long after his TNG appearance of a heart attack. The last film he appeared in, Mom and Dad Save the World, is dedicated to his memory. And of course, Carolyn Seymour appears in this episode as Sub-Commander Terrace. Seymour has appeared as four different characters in five episodes of the franchise. She would later appear as Marasta Yale in First Contact and as Commander Toreth in Face of the Enemy, as well as Mrs. Templeton in the Voyager episodes Cathexis and Persistence of Vision. She's a prolific star of stage and screen. She's got over 116 credits on her IMDb page. Her breakout role was in the 1972 film The Ruling Class, opposite Peter O'Toole. She would go on to roles in films including The Bitch, Mr. Mom, and Congo. She also made many TV appearances in shows like Survivors, The Greatest American Hero, Space 1999, L.A. Law, and she was one of the evil leapers on Quantum Leap. Hmm. She's also lent her voice to many video games. She's the voice of Queen Mira in the Gears of War series, and she's the voice of Dr. Chakwas in the Mass Effect universe. She's also appeared in both Knights of the Old Republic games, and she provided the voice of Mon Mothma in Star Wars Empires at War and Jedi Knight 2 Jedi Outcast. And I don't know. I'd have to hear her tell me how many Bothans died. I feel like it would be a colder delivery than we got from Caroline Blakiston. Is she sad they're dead? She kind of sounds like she's happy that they're dead.
Could be. It's like, you know, adding that. Maybe she just wanted to bring the room, you know, down a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. I think I mentioned before that early TNG, I just see it as like woke or TOS, right down to the, you know, sometimes backward sexual politics and the heavily emphasized Cold War backdrop. But I think TNG would change quite a bit over the course of its run, mostly due to the new blood in the writer's room and Michael Piller's program of accepting scripts submitted to the production. And like we said before, I'm not exactly sure how Gerber and Woods started collaborating or how they got to pitch to Paramount. But I think the influence of both of their backgrounds is definitely evident in the story's script, which boils down to computers and comedy.
Yeah.
Steve Gerber's style is comedy, and I think that definitely comes through in this episode. And I think that this is a funnier episode than Star Trek usually does. And it's something that we've been interrogating on the show recently, the idea that I don't think Star Trek's like all that funny. The idea that, I mean, it's not sold as a comedy, but for a show that's aimed at the family and it pretty effectively explores different aspects of life, it tends to be like not that funny. Or if there are jokes, they're kind of lame, like there'll be no tribble at all, that sort of thing.
Right.
And the kind of bits that are in this episode, they might be lame, but they're well-timed, I think. And I think they exploit well the setting that the characters are in. Like, I like that Picard gets a plant instead of the tea that he ordered, mm-hmm. or that the convenience of a turbo lift, especially in a critical situation, becomes Mr. Toad's wild ride for Geordi when he's on his way to the bridge.
Yeah. Yeah, and that... It does both kind of... I do like when Star Trek is funny. When it's funny, when it's a mix. I feel like if it tries to lean too hard into like just like, look at how funny, then it's, you know, outside of, you know, Trouble with Tribbles is its own thing. But
yeah.
I feel like if there's a good mix of stuff, like I really was pleasantly surprised at how the little kind of laugh moments in this that I was like, oh, I didn't realize they were doing that yet, essentially. Like, you know, they do get into that, but I feel like you need a little bit more character, maybe not character development, but I feel like, you know, the audience has to be a little bit more comfortable and familiar with characters in order for stuff like that to work.
Sure.
Which is why, you know, some of the best comedic moments from you know, the original cast is stuff that happens later or stuff that happens in the movies where you get these, okay, you know exactly who Kirk and Spock and Bones are, and you know, to obviously to an additional extent, you know, Scotty and Uhura and all, you know, who the classic, you know who the cast are, so you can play off of them playing off each other, and you can have like, oh, these pure moments that would work for their characters.
Yeah.
And I didn't think they had gotten to that yet with this cast and with this, you know, with this crew, and it's interesting to see that in there. I liked it.
Yeah. I think that many of the moments, other than like the Data specific moments about, you know, him dying and coming back to life and being like, what's going on? I think that it's down to like structure, and I think it's just like good writing on Gerber's part, because, you know, the next episode up is the Royale, which I was talking about worst episodes before, and I think maybe the Royale might belong in that conversation. And the whole thing is just all huge swing comedy stuff. You know, you've got the Data playing craps with the Texas oil man type stuff, and it all is just like, okay, like if this is bad on purpose, then, you know, mission accomplished. But if you think that we're all rolling in the aisles, I'm not sure that's happening.
Yeah, I don't know. It's tough to know. Now there's like a double lens between, you know, two pieces of gauze in between us and this episode, is that not only the you know, are we obscured from knowing what was going on in the producers' minds, but now there's also like, maybe this was funny in you know, 1989.
Yeah. I'm trying to think, was I laughing as a kid, like watching this? And I think Gerber's aware of the sort of puncturing of the balloon of ostentatiousness that Trek often has, that he's doing here. There's that very explicit line where the ship is failing and Troy, without looking at the camera, like Jim on The Office, you know, says, "Why, this would be kind of funny if this was happening, you know, in another time and place."
Right.
I think he knows what he's doing. His writing's also is also often existential, and I like that he's writing about this civilization of the Iconians, which I guess he created when you think about it. I don't think it existed in Star Trek lore before this episode. As far as I can tell, this is where they start. There's this mystery or this question of whether they were really warlike or if other races were jealous of their technology and kind of painted them poorly in history. And I like the idea of Varley as a man who is ostensibly as noble as Captain Picard, but he's like driven to this sort of desperate race to get his hands on this tech. You know, it's a matter of interstellar war. I think there's some big questions floating around in this episode, like big ideas.
Yeah, and, you know, both ideas of, you know, kind of what should be done, you know, purely on a tactical level, and what should be done on a kind of, you know, moral and interesting level too. And, you know, what it's again, it, not that it gets glossed over, but, you know, you could delve further. I think if you trimmed some of the fat of this episode, not that it goes too, it's not extra fatty, but if you trimmed a little bit of fat and replaced it with a little more kind of that deeper kind of, character, kind of not soul searching necessarily, but, you know, have him wrestling with some of these ideas a little bit more. Like he pretty much, Picard is just kind of like, oh, this guy, you know, my friend died because he was looking for this civilization. Like, oh, let's go do that. Like, you know, not a whim, but, you know, very much kind of like drop of a hat. He's like, hey, we're going to go do this. And it doesn't, you know, it seems a little bit obsessive, and you could throw in a little conversation about why they're doing this or something like that, you know, and have him, you know, have Riker be like, are you sure? Like, and that there's like one line in there about it, but you could really turn that into another kind of, you know, roundtable discussion, or at least, you know, ready room discussion of the nature of this, the moral implications, the tactical implications of, you know, of the, you know, being at war with the Romulans, or any of this stuff could have been delved into a little bit deeper, rather than, you know, I like the kind of extra pressure of the Romulans being there, but something there's a couple of disparate things, or maybe just the take out some of the kind of, you know, working with the technology, trying to figure stuff out. Because once the actual solution comes along, it's a little bit of a like, duh, that's it. You know, it's you know, literally like, well, let's just reboot it. And like, it's not, I'm not faulting it. You know, that's not the,
sure.
It wasn't the, you know, the whole crux of the point of the episode wasn't like a mystery of like, how are we going to solve this? It seems like a little bit simple for that to be there, so they could just kind of, you know, if they spent more time on something else, not to backseat, you know, produce a Star Trek episode.
Well, that's all we do.
And maybe that would be something that, you know, maybe if they did that today, I would be like, I wish they spent more time, you know, with the Romulans who are talking about how they're going to solve this problem, because they would be spending too much time with the, you know, soul searching kind of, conversations in the ready room. But
they brought it up. Like it's, I think that they invite the soul searching, especially when you, sure, it's a mechanical thing to have Picard be interested in archaeology, so he can pick up the scent of this quest that his friend was on, and also be instrumental in sort of interpreting what they find later. But I wanted more diving in and more of the philosophy of this civilization that they are uncovering, because they seem to be. If they are not warlike, as is kind of suggested in the episode, then they're explorers. They're explorers like Picard is, like Starfleet is. They develop these doorways and things to explore the universe, you know, and not use them to just show up and try to conquer places. If that's really what's going on, then I wanted to see a little more of a parallel drawn between what they were, you know, what their intentions were from Picard. But again, this is all just sort of like backseat producing, right, yeah. I guess. But I think that's interesting. That would be they'd have a really crappy Star Trek in that culture, because they don't have a, they don't have a ship. They don't ever run into anybody. They just show up where they're going.
Right. Yeah. There's no trekking. It's just doors.
Yeah. It's just, yeah. Just stars. Yeah. I've seen people criticize this illusion of turning it off and turning it back on again as being something that a 5-year-old could figure out. But they're thinking with 2021 head. You know, this is 2365 by way of 1989.
Right.
And we didn't know how that worked back then.
Yeah, that's true. Well, some of us. I feel like I could have, in 1989, well, I don't know. Going back to my thinking about my computer expertise at the time, and I was still pretty young, so I don't know if I would have. But, yeah, it wasn't as much of a thing culturally, and again, you know, like, you know, computer nerds, people who even knew what that, you know, again, going to the idea of having to explain to Roddenberry what a virus, what a computer virus might be, and what it could do,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Having that be enough of a kind of a mystical thing, like, still, I they can totally skate by on that. I'm not going to complain about it too much.
Sure. And it's, I think it's a compelling thing once you kind of accept it, that that the ship is being sort of infected by something. I read somebody was writing something on the internet about how there are plots in TNG, and this is one of them, that reflect a fear of infection or invasion. And they were trying to tie it to like the AIDS pandemic in the 80s. Hmm. And also, of course, I think people in society were becoming more aware of computer viruses. And now we don't have that, but you remember like the Michelangelo virus or whatever, or the Y2K bug. It feels like every 6 months or so, the news would be like, you know, don't open this email attachment or something like that. You know, be careful what you open. There's a facility now that we have with that where I don't even know how. I never bought like a virus program. I think Windows is just doing it for me. Like, everything's fine, so I'm not going to question it.
I've always been on the other side of the neutral zone. I went straight from Commodore 64 to Apple products. So
there you go.
I've never owned a Windows machine, and I feel like a little bit like, I don't know, like you poor fools. But I know I know one day it's going to come back and bite me, whatever. But it's I don't know. I've felt secure.
You have to wonder how computing works in the Federation as well, because they don't seem to have like antivirus. But then again, the way they describe, you know, we talk about it being a virus, but the way they describe it in the episode, it seems almost more like it's installing a new OS, like it's trying to overwrite the computing system. It isn't just that the Iconians all died because their computers had, you know,
right,
influenza or something. These probes actually, ostensibly in a effort to communicate, you know, are kind of, it's like, you know, hey, install Zoom so we can talk. So it's like installing something on your computer, but it's not jibing with the structure of computers in the 24th century.
Right. It's like if the installer was just like, okay, I'm going to install, you know, you know, Zoom for Windows on your machine. Oh, you're on a Mac? It's okay. I'm going to wipe your hard drive and install Windows first and then install.
Right.
And yeah. I think that, you know, any kind of antivirus or whatever that they have, I'm sure they have lots of, you know, lots of things of that nature, but it would only be effective for what they know and what the, you know, the types of attacks that they're used to and that they can.
Right. Maybe the Iconians were the IT guys for the universe at that time. And so, you know, when your computer goes wrong at work and the IT guy shows up and is like, all right, what'd you do? All right, get up. Maybe everybody finally had enough of them and then they destroyed them for that reason.
Yeah, that's why they needed the portal technology. They would just show up and fix people's stuff.
Yeah, that's how they sort of telnet in.
Right.
Picard does act a little weird in this episode, and I think it's not totally out of character, at least I think they call it out in the episode, but I was wondering if that was maybe Gerber writing the captain more like Kirk, or what he thought a captain would act like. I'm just assuming that he was a Star Trek fan of old.
Yeah, it does seem like they're not, and you know, part of that is us, you know, turning it around and looking at it, you know, with what we know about how the character developed over the course of, you know, seven seasons and you know, a couple movies, but also like it is, you know, them, you know, so if this is season two, that there's really, they have season one of content to base his characterizations on. And so it's, you know, they're still finding their footing a little bit. And I'm sure there are, you know, there were guidelines, absolutely. But it does seem a little bit out of character for him. But yeah, it does, you know, overall, that makes me think that it is more either, I don't know who to pin it on, you know, if it's Beth,
Woods.
Woods. Beth Slick, right? Cause that's what the,
yes. Or that's Beth what, Slick. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the, I think the BBS book is Beth Slick, but, her being a Star Trek fan, maybe kind of coming up with the idea, like, oh, there's a computer virus, and then, you know, coming in with it as more, you know, I'm sure maybe in her head written as more of a TOS kind of style episode, because that's, you know, having been a fan up to that point.
Yeah.
And then is that kind of Gerber just coming on and adding, I've written for television, let me add on some, you know, let me help structure it, and then we'll just drape your ideas over the structure, or was it, you know, vice versa? Is that he was, you know, also a fan and adding in, you know, she was there for the technical details and he was adding in the kind of more TOS-iness, the Kirkiness of it. But
I could see that. It's a very TOS situation, you know, a captain or someone that Kirk used to know dies very early. And then whatever the situation or hazard that he found himself in, Kirk is then forced to go into and try to solve the problem. They go into the neutral zone like, yeah, we're just going to go into the neutral zone, whatever. And then the Romulans confront them and they're like, well, you're here too.
Right.
And that can't be how international relations work in the galaxy. It's just like, you did it.
Sometimes, I mean, I think it's got to be that, you know, like, okay, like, I won't tell if you won't kind of a thing.
Yeah, that's true. But and there is, I think Kirk has some moral authority here because he does show up just as one of their ships mysteriously explodes. So it's like, yeah, we're here, but what happened here?
Yeah, it's interesting setup, interesting, yeah, it doesn't seem quite as TNG as we would, but again, like second season, they probably are figuring it out as they go along. And I'm trying to find out it's interesting how it doesn't seem like there's that much, or at least that much information on kind of copious rewrites, you know, for TOS. I've found as we've been doing our show.
Oh yeah.
Everything you can see, like, okay, you know, outline handed in here, you know, rewritten here, rewritten here, rewritten here, rewritten by Gene Kuhn at this point,
it's,
you know, like,
yeah,
given,
it's
handed
like minutes
off to
of the UN. Yeah. You
yeah.
Can find everything. Yeah.
And I was kind of a little surprised to be like, oh, like, let me crack into the, you know, the nitty gritty of what, you know, how this worked out. And it's just like, yeah, final draft on December 28th and the second revised draft on January 4th. And it's like, oh, that's it. And then it premiered on March 20th. It's like, that seems so smooth. And
and you can't ask Maura Hurley about it.
Yeah.
Some of those books, like the Unauthorized History of Star Trek and stuff, where they went down and made an oral history, can be really informative about finding out more about the process. But yeah, it isn't. It's weird to think that something made 50 years ago we have more information about than something made just 20 or 25 years ago.
Yeah.
What do you think about the use of the Romulans as an adversary? I guess it was maybe not all of Star Trek, but specifically like TNG, because they do kind of become the new Klingons or the new boogeyman.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not, I mean, I like that. I like certain aspects of that. I like that, you know, I feel like having a consistent, you know, foe, a consistent kind of enemy works for the nature of the show.
Yeah.
Although I do really love the way that that resolved with the Klingons from, you know, from the original series up until the movies. And so it, I guess it makes sense to just have the kind of Romulans step up because there was also, you know, it filling that void. And it makes sense for this. I guess I like it enough. I don't know. They do turn them a little bit. They do basically end up reusing a lot of the same stuff that they would be using for the Klingons on the Romulans, which I don't like as much. You know, they're just like reusing a lot of the same concepts of, you know, the way that their society operates and this, you know, this very kind of cold war. They do at times seem like a half step between Vulcans and Klingons, but I'm okay with it in general. I did, I'll throw in, I was watching this one with my son, who's three, and he's mainly only been watching original series episodes with me as I do my research for my show. And so when we, I put this one on, I'm like, so it's Star Trek, but it's going to be different. So there's different things going on. And he's like, yeah, I watched one of these with Granny. I'm like, okay, well. And, you know, first time we see the crew on the bridge, he like stopped me. He's like, whoa, why is there a Klingon there? Like, and it was a good, I was like, oh, like you, like, because they're friends now. Like, this is progress.
Ooh, wow,
like,
we get
to, yeah. Like, I was like, that was awesome. I got to see that click in a human. And so for that, but you know, I do love that progress. And I love that there's a little, kind of nod, you know, it's hard to remember that the kind of original cast movies and Next Gen were happening at the same time because we get that in here. You know, they're like, oh, well, if it's cloaked, she can't fire while she's cloaked. And Worf is like, unless they've gotten around that. And like has like a little bit of a, you know, you would go back and think like, oh, wait a minute, does he know something? And is he hiding something? Because you know, Star Trek VI happens just a couple years after this, I think, like 2 years after this. And it's like, oh, the Klingons did figure that out. Wait a minute.
Yeah, my grandpa used to say something about that happening. Yeah. I like their weird foreheads, but it's never consistent because whenever they need to have a hot Romulan, they never have the weird foreheads like Joanne Linville or any of the Romulans on the new Picard show. They're all hot.
I think they should have, you know, again, it's become a trope of, you know, a little bit of like, oh, a Star Trek alien, we'll just throw a funny nose on somebody, but they can just chill out with the, you know, the noses and foreheads and just make it, you know. Romulans, you know, they just looked like kind of like Vulcans because there was a little, that was the whole crux of it, you know, in Balance of Terror, that's the whole plot point. It's like, oh, well, these new villains and we don't know about them. And then we see them finally and it's like, wait a minute, Mr. Spock, they look just like you. Like, you know, having that shared ancestor, that's a cool part of this, you know, storyline of this, you know, world building, this history. So they don't need to go too far and make them all look all bumpy.
Yeah, but then they decide like, well, they can't look exactly the same, so maybe they've just got a little extra forehead going on.
Yeah, I don't know. I think just let them be. Just let them be, darn it.
Let them be. Their haircuts can be different, that's all.
Yeah. It's cheaper. Come on, that would be my selling point going in there. And if I was in the writer room, I'd be like making my point, trying to make my point, being like, no, it's cool. They'd be like, well, we're going to make them different because we're going to be like, it's cheaper. And then I'd get the producers on my side.
No, like Frank Gorshin, like this side of his face is black, but the other guy, the other side. Yeah. There's something that always kind of bugged me a little about technology in the Trek galaxy. It seems like all the races who are players on the galactic stage in the era of Star Trek are all essentially technological peers. And a lot of times in other sci-fi shows, you see a great disparity between the technology of one group as compared to another. But on Star Trek, there's like a technological status quo that everybody fits into. And I'm sure some of that has to do with, in universe, the technological sharing that goes on. You know, humans develop warp drive on their own, but I'm sure they get tips from the Vulcans later on. And we deal with that in this episode when the Enterprise finds the remains of an ancient civilization, which was clearly more technologically advanced than they are. And we see, you know, other episodes where they're always finding amazing ancient technology. I wonder if it's an important part of the world building of Star Trek that everybody has to be on an even playing field technologically for the conflicts to be believable.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that unless it, that you can make it, you know, within a certain limit, you know, you can have them, somebody be more technologically advanced, but then it's like, oh, but we can use our cleverness to, or, you know, our human spirit is what's going to allow us to defeat them or something like that. You know?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
But not just somebody who's just going to show up and, you know, blink you out of existence. But
yeah,
I assume that they can, that works better that way for narrative purposes. And then they can, you know, I think that it is sharing that kind of enables that on a plot level. You can, yeah, you can write it away as being like, well, once you get to, you know, hey, no interference while you're figuring it out. But once you get to kind of warp drive, then it's like, then we, it's almost like, I don't know if during the pandemic you played any Animal Crossing, but there's a certain, like, if you once you can get to other people's islands and you have some friends who have been working at this for a while, then like it seemed like hard work, and then so you know some friends, they'll just show up and be like, oh yeah, you're working really hard to try to get here's all the money you'll ever need to buy anything, here
oh,
you go.
Sure.
Like it's, you know, all of a sudden getting, once you make that first step to get onto somebody else's island, or in this case to get off your planet, you know,
yeah,
then it's like, oh hey everybody, welcome to the club, and then you instantly kind of get up to the same, more or less the same level as anybody else.
Okay. Yeah, my experience with that would be playing the Star Wars collectible card game back in the day, where I would just sort of play on my own and not really know what I'm doing, and then go to a tournament and see the other strategies and get destroyed, but then realize, oh, okay, this is, I can use this strategy or this strategy. And also having friends play it, everybody who plays a card game knows, you know, what it's like to get booster packs and to just hope and pray for something good, but if my friend's got like four Darth Vaders, he's like, oh, here you go. Use some of these Darth Vaders.
Right.
And now you can make your deck work. I like the idea that the galaxy is both a living and a dead thing. Like there's a civilizational continuity in the galaxy. I think it'd be really easy. And sometimes I think the storytelling in Star Trek can be a little simplistic. You know, if you just had intrepid Earthlings who are planting the American flag all over the Virgin Galaxy, that's like kind of boring. But I like the idea that not only are our explorers awed by the visual and scientific spectacles of the universe, but there's a humbling in realizing that no matter how technologically advanced the Federation feels, there's an old dusty Takan Empire or an Iconian Empire that's gone the way of the Dodo long ago.
Yeah, I do love that kind of wrinkle that gets worked in. I guess maybe that's why they made it a passion of it, you know, archaeology being a passion of Picard, so they could, you know, do this great kind of world building thing that you never got that much that I can think of. You never got that kind of in TOS, that kind of like idea of like, oh yeah, like there were other things that came before this. Although, well, that's not true. I guess the Guardian of Forever, and you know, there seems that there was like the ruins of an earlier civilization. Yeah, like you get like little hints of it, but not really. Yeah. It's always alive still to a certain extent, which I guess it is here. So,
yeah.
But adding that wrinkle of him being interested in this, and then making it again as our storytelling. I don't know if it's the storytelling kind of capabilities or the, you know, the trust with the audience builds as we go on, that, you know, you can have more continuity stuff like this now in the 80s than you could in the 60s, because people are on board, versus, you know, you're less worried about somebody just kind of tuning in for the first time being like, what the hell's an Iconian? I don't know this show.
Yeah, right. Come on, man. I can barely remember Spock's name. I like the idea of too of archaeology in the future. You know, sometimes it's going to be tombs and temples, but with an empire that lasted 200,000 years, it's just as often going to be plastic and metal.
Oh,
so you're not just Indiana Jones with a brush. Like, you know, instead of finding a cartouche, you find a zune. You're like, oh, this is an ancient artifact. We have to figure out how this works.
Totally.
Trek gets a lot of credit for creating things or predicting technologies, but in this episode, they've essentially created email search and voice transcription and recognition all at the same time, with a scene where Picard goes through Varley's logs, which, by the way, we don't often see our captain's recording logs, but Varley is doing it like a vlog, like he's doing it right to camera. And I didn't know if like that's a personal choice that he made. Hey, what's up? It's your Captain Varley. Or if I'd have to imagine that there's a lot of work that the computer does for you these days. So maybe it is like a generated image of him. Like if you talk to somebody on your view screen, what if you're getting out of the shower, right? You're not always going to be ready to talk to somebody. We've all experienced that with Zoom and Skype. So maybe the computer just makes a deep fake of you delivering your log or your monologue.
Well, I think these are his personal logs, right? This isn't like captain's log. You know, this isn't like official on the record.
He does do a couple personal logs, but I think some of it is his captain's log as well. I could be wrong.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, to me it seemed like it was more just kind of like his personal journal or personal, side notes on things.
Yeah.
What he was dealing with and kind of, you know. That there would be an additional kind of, you know, captain's log being the official kind of indication of what the ship was doing. And then this was a supplemental kind of side log of him being like, hey, this, check it out. We found this planet. We're going to, I don't know what the heck this thing is, but we're going to.
Playing with this Zune. I can't figure out what it is. Yeah.
So the names or the songs are all wrong. I don't understand.
Yeah. And I can't, it's got a proprietary plug. I can't plug it in and charge it. Anything else that you've left unsaid in this episode? We've covered quite a bit.
The only other thing I had was, why not a shuttlecraft? Because if the computers are on the fritz, yeah. I'm assuming that the shuttlecraft, you know, has its own computer.
Yeah.
So it probably wouldn't be as affected. All you have to do is just make sure the doors stay open. But
sure.
I don't know if I would trust, you know, as much as, hey, O'Brien is great, I don't know that I would trust him when he was like, yeah, everything's working fine. Like, okay, we're going to put the captain and the robot on here? Like, are you sure? Like, shouldn't we send down some, you know, inert matter or some unicorn dogs or something first? Like, come on.
Right.
Like, what?
Yeah.
We're just going to be okay with this? Like,
yeah, you have to wonder where they were at in terms of just their thinking about computer science. Like, I think it's a really great observation by Beth Woods that, you know, we've got this computer that we rely on and it's got the voice of Mitchell Barrett and everything, but like, what if you get a virus? What if something goes wrong?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of things that, of course, Star Trek couldn't predict, like wireless communication. Like, anytime you're working really hard, you've got six pads on your desk and it's like, no, like wireless, there would be a cloud, and we can kind of retcon that. And when Picard asks Worf to destroy the tricorder, it's like, well, no, you can just like, don't plug it into anything, and you could study the program that way, or you could keep the record that you've got from the civilization. But you could just headcanon that tricorders, you know, work through wireless technology. So if you bring it back to the ship, it would spread it wirelessly to the computer. And so I think that for something that was written in like 1988, 1989 about computers, it remains pretty believable and consistent.
Yeah.
But absolutely, having a robot crew member, that's a don't bring that guy. That's a liability.
Oh, yeah, it definitely, you know, this is my first time revisiting it in a while, and so I was definitely like ready for a little bit more cringy kind of, you know, like the movie Hackers or something like that, where it's going to be like, you know, I did have a little like titter when he said, you know, like, yeah, well, you know, it's separate from our mainframe. I was like, nobody says mainframe anymore, Geordi. Maybe
right,
they will.
That doesn't. Yeah.
Maybe they will in the future again. It'll come back.
Yeah. They need to take the track order back and put it on an air gapped system that's, we're running extra encryption with so on and so forth hackers.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk My Space Dad Can Beat Up Your Space Dad. Last time you were on the show, you said that you were not ready yet to not say Kirk was your favorite captain. So I think that means that Kirk was your favorite captain. Has that changed? And how do you think Kirk would have handled this situation, assuming that Picard didn't hit all the Kirk beats?
I don't like him to be... I'd like, as much as I do still feel like Kirk is my captain, I think that when I don't like my Picard to be Kirky...
Okay, sure.
That it's too, you know, like, no, I let that be. It's the merits of Picard are that he's not Kirk.
Right.
And that, you know, let's lean into that, you know, that he's best when he's furthest from that, perhaps. You know, sure. And let Riker do the kind of, you know, I think it was the Mad Magazine parody that they called him, you know, Commander Re-Kirk. So like, it's like let him do the Kirky stuff, and that's not what we're here. That's not what we're necessarily here for. Like, I like this extra level of having a captain, which makes more sense. You know, for what an actual captain would be, he would be the one with the ship. That would be his first concern. So,
yeah, I suppose the Iconian computer would have to have some kind of vocal interface that Kirk could talk to death or reason with. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. instead of pressing the buttons, he would have to have convinced it, you know, to somehow keep the doors closed.
Right. Destroy yourself. Right.
Computer. Like in his little finger up, I'm clever voice.
Right. But, yeah.
But yeah, I do have, I, you know, I mentioned my son said he had watched an episode with Granny, and my mother-in-law is very much a TNG, a Picard enthusiast. Oh, and I do want to, I mean, I, you know, being where I am now, just, you know, I want to go back and revisit, like I said, TNG, and I think I'll redevelop an appreciation for Picard doing so. I understand what's good about him, but he's not going to supplant Kirk in my heart yet. You know, as time goes on, who knows?
Yeah,
the nostalgia factor that really ties me to Star Trek is becoming more and more of a thing with Next Gen. So maybe, you know, as enough nostalgia builds up, I'll be like, oh yeah, wait,
one more rewatch down, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
Now that we've reached the end of the show, you receive a promotion to the rank of Lieutenant Junior Grade. Hmm. And last time you said that you would be probably working in engineering, but you also said that you like the blue shirts of the Sciences Division. And I suggested that you could be a social engineer and work in the Diplomatic Corps. Hmm. The Enterprise runs roughshod over quite a few intergalactic rules and bylaws here, not to mention cruising around through the neutral zone. So as a diplomat, how would you smooth over the tensions with the Romulans?
I do think that there would have to be that, you know, hopefully if I'm in a diplomatic situation that I have, you know, my counterpart, essentially, who, you know, we'd be able to pull off that kind of, hey, I won't tell if you won't kind of a thing.
Sure.
I have a strong memory of being, let's say, sixth grade or something, and I was leaving the school lunchroom with an ice cream cone, which was a no-no, but it was, you know, late for one class or something. So it's basically going a short distance in the hallway with an ice cream cone where I shouldn't have been. And turn the corner, almost literally run into a teacher who was also eating an ice cream cone. And she looked at me for a second with this, like, I saw her gaze, like, in my mind, I'm like, oh, I'm caught. And in her mind, she was like, I'm caught. Oh, no, wait. He thinks he's caught. Like, and then, like, I saw it cycle through her mind, and then she just kind of looked at me and said, I won't tell if you won't. And then I was like, okay. Then I just went to my class. She went back to her office. And would need my counterpart in the Romulan Empire to be like, look, you know, we both know that something was up here. And, you know, we lost a ship and we helped you save your ship. So let's just pretend nothing happened. You know, let's erase
this
whole...
It's a lot of paperwork. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Both ships erased their logs. So there's no record of this. Let's just, you know, I'm trying to think of what, you know, like, Tali, baby, look, let's just take it. We'll pretend nothing happened. There's no records of it. We'll just start a new day tomorrow.
Yeah, it's true. There is no record of this. If everybody just shuts up, they're fine. little Romulan ale. I'd love to think that, you know, the humans love Romulan ale. I'd love to think that, like, Romulans love some earth beverage, like a little Romulan ale, little Coors for you, and right, we call it good. Take it.
We send them all of our Zima because it's like, yes, like, oh, they think it's exotic. And
I know, they can't get enough of it. Right. Yeah. Well, Lieutenant the Retailer, thanks for joining me to talk about Star Trek and the Star Trek universe. If people want to continue the conversation, and they can, at EISTpod on Twitter and the Enterprising Individuals Facebook page, where can people find you online?
I usually try to tie everything through PeteTheRetailer.com. That links to Star Wars Minute and ABCDTOS and older stuff like ABC Devo and Alphabetical and Nerd Geek Dork, which was the first kind of podcast that I made. And you can follow me at Pete the Retailer on Twitter. I tend to hang out there, and sometimes I yell about Star Wars or Star Trek, and sometimes it's sports because that's a thing that I'm nerdy about now.
All right. Well, thanks again for joining me, and we are signing off until the next mission. Hailing frequencies closed. Backtracking is back for an all-new season. Hi, I'm Caliban.
And I'm Gooey Fame.
And we'd like to introduce you to Backtracking, the podcast that explores the real-world inspirations behind your favorite episodes of Star Trek.
From historical events to classical literature to blockbuster films, we go where no pod has gone before to seek out the origins of classic Trek tales.
Did you know, Gooey, that the TNG episode Too Short a Season was an allegory for the Iran-Contra affair?
Yeah, only sweatier. Did you know that the Enterprise episode Regeneration was an homage to the John Carpenter film The Thing?
Archer and T'Pol freezing to death over a bottle of whiskey would have been a controversial ending.
As a dog lover, Archer would not like The Thing, I'm guessing.
Oh my god, movie night is canceled. Join us every other Thursday for a journey back to the beginnings of the Trek universe.
Backtracking is available wherever you get your podcasts.
No, Porthos!